Welcome to PFT Live. We're back after 6 days off. It's kind of like riding a bicycle, I hope. Although I used to crash a bicycle from time to time. So maybe I'll crash it today. Robert Mathis crashing out of the first 25% of the 2014 NFL season due to a four-game suspension. I was on Ross Tucker's podcast, and he made a good point. I never thought of it this way. You're talking about the equivalent of 40 games in baseball, 20 games in basketball or hockey. That's a big chunk of the season that Robert Mathis won't be available. And he was one of the best defensive players in the league last year, despite an advanced age. And maybe he was so good because of the substance that he was taking, Clomid reportedly. Whatever it was a violation of the league's policy regarding performance-enhancing drugs. And keep in mind that unlike the substance abuse policy, which allows a guy to violate it several times before he's ever suspended, it's one strike and you're down four games as far as the performance-enhancing drug policy is concerned. And through all the statements and counterstatements and arguments and discussion and the supposed need for compassion and perspective, look, here's the perspective. The NFL and the NFLPA agreed a long time ago as to what would be prohibited under the steroids policy, which is much broader and includes, at least for now, substances like Adderall. But there is a wide variety of substances that players can't take. Those were all determined not by the NFL issuing a proclamation from on high, but via an agreement reached between the NFL and the NFLPA. So the union that represents Robert Mathis has agreed that Clomid will be, if that's the fertility drug he took, and multiple reports indicate that it is, but the union agreed that that would be on the list. And the union agreed to a procedure that results in one strike, four-game suspension, strict liability. Somebody could sprinkle it in your food at Chili's, and it would still result in a one-game suspension, or four-game suspension, rather. One strike, four-game suspension, no matter how it gets into your system. If it's there, that's it. That is the procedure that the union has bargained for. The appeal process also was bargained for. The appeal process, in this case, utilized in the end result, four-game suspension. And I don't care what anyone says. That's the rule. That's the policy. That's the outcome. And I think what happens is, and I can't really fault the player or his agent for this, but what happens is there's a PR battle that is waged separately, and people try to convince the general public and also potential sponsors and anyone who would have possibly a dimmer view of the player who is essentially caught cheating that he really didn't cheat. But under that standard, pretty much everybody who ever gets caught didn't cheat, which would mean the NFL's policy only catches guys who didn't cheat, which means the cheaters are getting away with it because anyone who gets caught wasn't a cheater. And let's hope that the next phase of the NFL agreement for the substance abuse and performance-enhancing drug policy allows the league to say more about what it is that a guy did. We saw the league kind of step out of character a little bit with Robert Mathis, the statement that was issued in response to his agent's remarks. The new policy, if and when the HGH testing issue is resolved, will allow, we reported recently, that the NFL can say more about what it is that a guy did, can say what substance he took, can say more. So it isn't just this vacuum that's filled by whatever the player feels like saying. And it happens all too often. I took a tainted supplement. It was Adderall. The dog ate my homework, et cetera, et cetera. Hopefully the league will be able to stop that. So the overriding purpose of the policy is met, which is to deal with cheaters and send a message to anyone out there, the public, kids who are playing football, whatever, that if you take these substances, you will get caught and you will be penalized and there won't be some excuse that will allow the player to be painted as a victim. The victim here is the sport because, yet again, there's been another guy who was caught cheating. And if you don't know the rules and you're making that much money and there's that much riding on it, then shame on you. You need to know the rules. And it's not all that hard for anyone to figure out what substances are and aren't permitted under the league's performance-enhancing drug policy. Different issues arise in regard to defensive end Michael Sam of the St. Louis Rams with this reality show that was on. And now it's off. And did the league know before the draft? The league says it didn't know. Either way, the teams didn't know. And that's the great irony here. Michael Sam is championed for his courage in acknowledging his sexuality. But it looks like Michael Sam and Oprah's network concealed from any team that may have been interested in drafting him a fairly important point regarding the extent to which that issue was going to be made into a potential distraction, not by others, but by the player. And you can't have it both ways here. You can't say you just want to be a football player and then also revel in the things that go along with being the first openly gay NFL player. And look, Michael Sam just needs to acknowledge that no matter what he does in the NFL, he could be Reggie White, and he still will not get away from the fact that he was the NFL's first openly gay player. And you can't have it the other way. And you definitely can't try to be a normal football player but also set up this reality show that ultimately has been postponed. We could do a reality show about whether or not there was going to be a reality show, because that's become a reality show. And the NFL is the ultimate reality show. And the only thing that would make this complete would be the Rams being involuntarily drafted into the Hard Knocks assignment, because they are one of the eight teams that could be told by the NFL, whether you like it or not, you're doing Hard Knocks this year. And I don't know, Hard Knocks may have nothing on what we saw over the last few days regarding whether or not Michael Sam would indeed have a reality show. But, you know, all in all, in the 9 days since Michael Sam was drafted, I don't think the reaction has been as intense as people thought it would be. It has not lingered. It wouldn't even be talked about now if it wasn't for this on-again, off-again, off-for-now reality show. But if he wants to make the team, he needs to focus on making the team. He needs to focus on everything he needs to do, because it's not going to be easy for Michael Sam to earn one of the final 53 roster spots when that rolls around in early September, and that's going to be here before we know it. What's already here, regardless of what happens in September, is Jaguar Mania. How about the number of people who showed up for a rookie mini camp this weekend in Jacksonville, shattering the training camp record of 4,500. Saturday, more than 6,200 showed up for a rookie minicamp, which consists of draft picks, undrafted free agents, and guys there on a tryout basis. Jacksonville fans, they're stepping up, and they're excited about their team. They're excited about the arrival of Blake Bortles. They're excited about where things are going under Coach Gus Bradley and GM Dave Caldwell. They're excited about the offseason moves. They're excited about everything. And the NFL has to love that, because it proves yet again that in the offseason, when everyone is 0-0, hope springs eternal, plausible or otherwise. Every fan of every team thinks this year could be the year. And for the Jaguars, it's not just the year to win a championship, it's the year to be relevant again. It's the year to contend, to at least try to get to the postseason. Every team has a different scale on which success is going to be measured for the coming year. And for the Jaguars, winning the Super Bowl, I mean, that would be a great bonus. But just getting to the playoffs again, just having something to fight for in December, just having a team week in and week out that you feel like can win in any given game, the Jaguars could be moving toward that. And unlike another team that drafted a quarterback in the first round, which seems to be shunning the relevance that suddenly has arrived, the Jaguars seem to be embracing it, and they should. Look, it's not the time to be coy. There are many ways to be successful in the NFL, and one way to be successful is to be relevant, because if you are relevant, you get talked about a lot, you sell more jerseys, you sell more tickets, your games are on a broader swath of the national TV radar. Don't run away from it when relevance comes. Embrace it, and that's what the Jaguars are doing, and that's what the Jacksonville fans are doing, and it's a fun story as we prepare for the 2014 season, especially because the Jacksonville Jaguars are in a fairly wide-open division in the AFC South. When we return, we're going to flip over to the other conference and go in the other direction, the NFC North, specifically the Detroit Lions. Some news always with the Lions of late in recent years, and we'll catch up with Dave Burkett of the Detroit Free Press when we return to talk about Ndamukong Suh, Eric Ebron, and other stuff. And then we'll talk to you. It's been a while, but it's time to answer your questions. We've got a Twitter bag ready. We'll have the phone lines open. We'll do that to end the show. Before that, we'll talk to Dave Burkett. Before that, we'll take a break. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live.
You know, he's a great player, and he's also got great leadership ability as well. And so to you know, have him back here working amongst the group is going to be, you know, a great time for everybody, I think. Do I know that he'll be here? I would anticipate that he will be here.
As Lions coach Jim Caldwell talking about the guy who has been AWOL for the initial phases of the offseason program in Detroit, Ndamukong Suh. It's not mandatory, but he's a team leader. He's a captain. He's in a contract year. He skipped the mini camp, that extra mini camp that you get when you have a new coach. Suh hasn't been around. Caldwell expects him to be there tomorrow. Joining us now to shed further light on that topic and other topics involving the Detroit Lions, our good friend Dave Bruquette of the Detroit Free Press. And Dave, let's start with Ndamukong Suh. Do you expect him to be there tomorrow?
Yes, Mike. This is typically the time of year that he's shown up in the past and taken part in OTAs, the last 2 years at least. And you know, it's my understanding he's been around a little bit. He's been around town. He's been in the building occasionally this offseason. He just hasn't been, you know, working out with the team. And, you know, again, that kind of follows the MO he's had in recent years. But, you know, I'm with you 100%. You know, new coach, new regime, new everything. You should be there for his first meeting as a coach. You should be there for the voluntary minicamp.
Do we know why he has made a habit of staying away when so many other players in the NFL are now there, especially since the offseason program is shorter than it used to be?
Yeah, no, this is, it's the routine that he's followed in recent years. And I don't know if I totally buy it, you know, that that's the only reason, because, you go back in 2011 was a lockout year, so he didn't have an offseason. In 2012, he was there a little bit more. Last year, he wasn't there quite as much. He does, you know, he works out in at Nike headquarters in Portland when he's there. He does a lot of sort of off-field, things to, help with his business interests. I know he spent some time with Warren Buffett and Magic Johnson this offseason. So he does some things to kind of better himself personally, which I don't think anybody would say he's wrong for doing that. I just think, you know, when you're out in Las Vegas the weekend before workouts start, and when you can fit it in your schedule to go to Larry Fitzgerald's charity softball tournament, I think you should be able to fit it in your schedule to go to a voluntary minicamp or your new coach's first meeting with the team too.
There's a contractual issue that's looming over this relationship, and Ndamukong Suh has a cap number north of $22 million. This year, he's entering the final year of that rookie contract. Any word on progress made as the two sides try to work out an extension that would also create, presumably, significant cap room this year?
Yeah, it's still my understanding that the Lions at least are, hopeful and anticipating that the deal will get done sometime this summer. But I don't know that that's a slam dunk by any means. They've had, talks, occasionally throughout this offseason. I think those talks obviously will continue once the Lions get all their draft class wrapped up and once, Sue's agent gets all of his draft picks wrapped up and all the other contractual things he has going on. But, the Lions are still hopeful that it's going to happen. And frankly, if they don't get it done this summer, there's a better than average chance that he's not going to be a Lion because of that contract situation that you mentioned and the salary cap number, the franchise number that he'd have next year.
And you've got Suh in the final year of his contract. You've got Nick Fairley, a first-round pick in 2011, in the final year of his contract because the team opted not to exercise its right to extend the contract to a fifth season. Both starting defensive tackles possibly gone next year. We're going to talk about the guy the Lions did take at number 10. I want to focus first on the guy they didn't take because I was certain, Dave, that the Lions would take Aaron Donald if he was there at number 10, and he was. Why didn't they take Aaron Donald?
Yeah, we talked about him, I think, maybe a month or so before the draft, and I thought he was a viable possibility. Mike, I think the way the board broke for the Lions, the cornerback that they liked most, Justin Gilbert, was gone. All the pass rushers that they liked, obviously Clowney and Mack and throw Anthony Barr in the mix, those guys were gone, and the top two offensive or the top two receivers were gone. So I think when the Lions looked at it, they decided to gamble on big and athletic and get another weapon for Stafford. Donald, I know there were people in the organization that liked him and liked him a lot. I just think, from a size perspective, he's not exactly what this regime wants in its defensive tackles. And, kind of like Odell Beckham, another option that could have been there at 10 or was there at 10 for them that they passed on being, maybe a little bit undersized for the position. At the end of the day, the Lions just wanted to get another weapon, and they went with the bigger athletic target as opposed to a defensive lineman that could help maybe down the road for him.
And now the Lions have Calvin Johnson, Golden Tate, Reggie Bush, Joique Bell, Brandon Pettigrew, Joseph Fourier at tight end. Are they going to pass tomorrow at the league meetings in Atlanta a rule that you can use two footballs? I mean, how do you fit Eric Ebron into this equation?
Yeah, you know, I was talking to a scout after the draft, and you know, he was befuddled a little bit by the pick, and he said, no, they can already score 38 points a game and lose. What are they going to do now? Score 42 and lose? I mean, it's, you know, to some people, I know it didn't make a ton of sense. I mean, I think from the Lions' perspective, this offseason has been all about Matthew Stafford and getting him all the tools he needs to succeed. And I think this was just another case of that. You know, Ebron, the Lions are going to use him a lot like, you know, the Saints use Jimmy Graham. Obviously, new offensive coordinator Joe Lombardi is familiar with Graham from his time in New Orleans. So you're going to see him on the field a lot this year, along with Calvin and Golden Tate and Brandon Pettigrew and one of those running backs. And I think he, you know, I understand it from the standpoint that it gives the Lions a lot of options on offense, but, I'm kind of lukewarm to the pick, and not because he's not a talent, just because, it's not the sexiest throw. It's not the quickest way to win, I don't think, with what the Lions already had.
And what does it mean, Dave, for the guys who are already there at tight end, Pettigrew and Fourier?
Well, you know, I think for Fourier in particular, it kind of, you know, leaves him in limbo a little bit. I mean, it's tough to see him having any bigger role than he had last year when he was essentially a red zone threat. I mean, you know, Ebron is going to be on the field and playing a receiver sort of position a lot of the time. He's going to be split out in the slot. So, Fourier is not going to take reps from him. You know, Brandon Pettigrew is a better blocker. And if you're looking for versatility and you need a tight end end line, you know, he's going to be the guy there. So, Fourier is the guy that seems to, you know, maybe lose out on this a little bit. But I would point out that, you know, Brandon Pettigrew, he re-signed this offseason, obviously a four-year deal, but his guaranteed money ends after this season. So if it came, you know, if the Lions are looking down the road, it could be a point where Ebron takes over for Pettigrew, sooner rather than later.
They ignored the offense, or they ignored the defense, rather, in the first round. They went over to the defensive side of the ball, round two, Kyle Van Noy, the linebacker from BYU. What'd you think of that pick?
You know, I thought it was a good pick. I mean, it was a guy that fit them, and, you know, they want to bring a little more pressure from their strong side linebacker position, and Van Noy is going to be a day one starter for them, and, you know, they're going to use him as a stand-up rusher a little bit in nickel situations. The only question I kind of had about it, Mike, was, you know, they traded up to get him, and, you know, again, I thought he was a good pick, and he fits, but maybe you sit pat, you keep, they gave up an early fourth round pick, and I think you could get maybe him or a comparable player if they would have stayed put at 45 and maybe helped their secondary a little bit if they held on to that fourth rounder, because what they ended up doing was, you know, third round they took a backup offensive lineman and then they had to wait till the end of the fourth round to get more defensive help, and by that time they saw eight cornerbacks go off the board, you know, in the early part of the fourth round, and that left them to take Nevin Lawson, a guy who, you know, physically, he kind of fits what they want to do in terms of being a press man guy, a guy who's strong at the line of scrimmage, but he's a little on the smaller side. And I think the Lions, especially with the injury concern about Chris Houston and his toe, I think they could have used some more help in the secondary.
Do you see any opportunities going forward for them to beef up the secondary? I mean, a trade could happen at any time. Are there any free agents floating around out there they could sign? Do you think they'll wait to see who gets cut? How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, you know, I never say never. I mean, at this stage, I don't know that you're going to get an impact guy out there. And, you know, I think the Lions, their best hope is that, Darius Slay turns out to be the player that they think he can be this year. He was benched early last year. He did play well at the end of the season, but if they can get him playing at a high level, then, you know, then maybe they'll be okay there. You know, Rasheen Mathis is back. I mentioned Chris Houston had toe surgery. He not sure if he's going to be ready for the start of camp or not yet this year. When I talked to him, he didn't seem too certain about that. So, Lawson or Bill Bentley, one of those guys in the nickel. So I don't think there's a whole lot of help out there. I don't get the sense that they would be looking to trade for Brandon Flowers, who's been rumored to be on the market. But I guess you can never rule out adding some of that extra help.
Moving forward, where do you think things stand right now with the Lions? How competitive do you see them being this coming season, given everything that they've done this offseason?
Well, I think they're in the mix. You know, I mean, I think it's still, you know, Green Bay's division to win. I mean, obviously, when you have Aaron Rodgers and you have some of the weapons that they have, that's going to be a tough one to contend with. But, the Lions, before they had their meltdown last year, they looked pretty good at times. And that was without even, you know, taking advantage of some of the other injuries in the division. So, you know, I think their offense should be good enough and potent enough that they can score with a lot of teams. I still have some questions about the back end, and of course, you know, Nick Fairley's motivation, and you know, we'll see what how much pressure they can get up front. You know, I think the Lions and the Bears are kind of fighting for number two behind the Packers for now, though.
One of the draft picks used by the Lions this year was on a kicker. That doesn't happen all that often, but they like something they saw in Nate Freese of Boston College. Will he be the kicker this year?
I think so. It's back-to-back years, too, that they've taken a specialist. They kind of, you know, took a page out of the Vikings book with that. You know, they had some success last year in the fifth round with Sam Martin, who, you know, he's going to be the punter for the foreseeable future, had a pretty good rookie season. You know, and Freeze is a really accurate guy. He did not miss a field goal last year at Boston College, and they think he's a guy that can, you know, hold that kicking spot down. So him and Giorgio Tavecchio are gonna battle it out in camp, but I think Tavecchio would have to, you know, be the clear winner for them to go in his direction, just from a simple fact that, you know, you mentioned it. It's not often you spend a draft pick on a kicker, and when you do, you usually expect him to come in and contribute for you.
You talked earlier about everything the Lions have done to try to give Matthew Stafford more weapons. Is there a shelf life with Stafford, or is he the quarterback for as long as he's able to play in the NFL?
Yeah, you know, look, I think Stafford is a really talented guy, and he's a pretty good quarterback at the end of the day, and I think the Lions are, you know, fortunate to have him in a lot of respects. You know, he's better than a lot of quarterbacks in the NFL, but when I look at the Lions situation right here, I think they have a two-year window to kind of approve it window. You know, that's when Stafford's guaranteed money runs out. You know, Jim Caldwell has come in and talked about making the playoffs and being able to contend right away. And obviously, you know, Bill Ford Jr. and Martha Ford taking over as owners after William Clay Ford's passing earlier this year. I think the whole regime has kind of 2 years to you know, make good on its promise. And at that point, if the Lions aren't a playoff team, if they're still struggling in the win department, you know, I think that's when, you know, maybe you look for another change to happen. And, you know, if that happens, there's no telling, you know, all bets are off with a new regime, what they think about Stafford, or if they want to go in their own direction at quarterback, because I mentioned it, you know, his guaranteed money is up in 2 years. So, you know, as I look at it, I think 2014 and 2015 are really big years for the Lions as an organization.
How big of a year is it now for Martin Mayhew, the GM, who took over after Matt Millen was fired? And at times it seems like maybe Mayhew's in trouble. Is he on the hot seat? Is he the guy we'd point to saying he's in the most trouble going into this season?
You know, I think there's definitely some heat under his seat. You know, I think he feels should feel the pressure. I don't know that there, you know, that there's any danger of him, you know, losing his job or anything this year. I think the Lions, you know, they committed to him, you know, last year by letting him pick a second coach, and, you know, keeping all of his scouts, all of his front office, everybody basically that he wanted around. So, you know, last year when they had the change, when Jim Schwartz was gone, he was definitely feeling some heat. I think everybody in that regime was. There was some uncertainty about what was going to go on. But, you know, the Fords are historically patient, and Bill Ford Jr. is not going to be quite as patient as his dad was. But I do think that they're going to give this regime, front office and coaching staff, a chance to see this through. And like I said, I think they have kind of 2 years to prove that they are the right men for the job.
Well, we'll see what happens when the season unfolds. We'll also see what happens as the week unfolds. Will Sue show up? What will he have to say? And should be interesting. We'll be checking it all out on the Detroit Free Press website. Thanks, as always, for your time, Dave. We'll talk soon.
No problem, Mike. We'll talk again.
All right, there he is, Dave Burkett, Detroit Free Press, getting you up to date on the Detroit Lions. After the break, you're going to get me up to date on what your questions are. We've got the Twitter questions, as we always do. But we need you to pick up your cell phone device and dial 888-237-5269. Dial us up now. Call us up. Ask your question. We haven't done this since before the draft. And you may have a few draft-related questions. You can ask me anything else you want. 888-237-5269. Do it now. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live. Straight to the list of Twitter questions. That's where we always go when we do the PFT Planet segment. There's the logo, which means it's time to answer your questions. And the first one comes from I Am Adam Kennedy. I am answering your question, I Am Adam Kennedy. Your question is, if Watkins is lights out and proves to be worth the picks, but Manuel struggles greatly, was Watkins worth it? Of course, that's Sammy Watkins and EJ Manuel, both members of the Buffalo Bills. It's hard for the receiver to play lights out and the quarterback to struggle, because the only way that the receiver can thrive is if the quarterback is getting him the football. So they're kind of bound together, and that's one of the age-old philosophical questions as to what makes a great receiver. Is it a great quarterback, or does a great receiver make a quarterback better? Regardless, if Watkins is great, Manuel isn't going to be struggling. And this all comes down to what the team does. The team has to be sufficiently successful. So the new owner of the Bills, and there will be one within the next year or so, it would be a surprise if there isn't, the new owner has to want to keep the current regime in place. Doug Whaley went all in with that move, five spots up from 9 to 4, giving up next year's first round pick. He may not be there to use it anyway. You may as well give it up. That's what this was all about. So to answer your question, and I'm not sure that I actually have, but if Watkins is lights out, Manuel will be playing better, and that means the trade will have been worth it if the Bills become a contender, because the Bills have to be a real contender so that the mob would never accept it if the new purchaser of the Bills tries to fire the GM. The team has to be so good that you have to keep the GM and keep the head coach. I think that's what the Sammy Watkins trade was all about, going all in to save a job that may not be there once the owner takes over the Bills, whoever that new owner may be. To the phone lines, Jared in Baltimore, you're on PFT Live.
Hey, what's up, Mike?
Hey, buddy, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing good. I just want to get your opinion, because, I mean, I hear a lot of, like, just chatter and stuff. Do you honestly believe that none of these first-round quarterbacks is going to start? Like, come on now. Like, every quarterback that was picked in the first round from 2012 to 2013 all started week one. Do you honestly believe, like, Brian Hoyer, Chad Henne, Matt Castle is going to outplay those guys in camp? Like, I understand, like, they didn't want to throw him to the fire. You know, a lot of GMs are on the hot seat right now because they don't want to get fired, obviously, because especially GM for Vikings, because he already missed out on Christian Ponder. I understand they don't want to throw him in the fire already and mess up their chances of being a long-term success, but do you honestly believe any of these guys is not going to start week one?
I don't believe any of them will be on the bench week one unless they are just flat-out horrible. It's a great observation, and I've long believed that if you're going to use a first-round pick on a quarterback, you got to be ready to use him, especially since that's now the default presumption. It used to be you'd put the guy on the bench for a year, but everything in the NFL is win now, and there's a greater sense of that than ever. At the league meetings, I was shocked at the teams that have had recent success year in and year out, where you talk to the people who run that team, and there's this sense, we've got to win now, we've got to win now. Everybody realizes, if you're not successful this year, you could lose your job. And for general managers, you lose your job, you're not going to be a general manager again. It's very, very rare that a guy comes back and gets hired again as a GM. So I think all three of these guys, Blake Bortles, Johnny Manziel, Teddy Bridgewater, unless they are just flat out horrible, they're going to be starting week one. So you make them backups, you give them a hurdle that they can overcome, they develop some confidence, and then you also protect yourself, because if you make these guys starters and then they're horrible, what do you do? Do you bench the guy before week one? So I understand why they do it, but I don't believe that any of these guys will be on the bench week one. And I remember saying this very strongly 2 years ago with Ryan Tannehill, who was number 3 on the depth chart in Miami. He's going to start. It's just a matter of time before he starts. And I think it's just a matter of time before Bortles is the starter, Manziel's the starter, and Bridgewater is the starter. Back to the Twitter bag. We need to get an actual Twitter. I say Twitter bag, there is no bag. There's nothing. There's no paper. It's just electronic. At Red Zone Alk, what should the Browns do, if anything, with Josh Gordon if he receives a lengthy suspension? Well, you just sit and you wait. Because if Josh Gordon does receive a lengthy suspension, he will have to remain clean or he'll never get back in. If the report's accurate that he's facing a 1-year suspension, that means he was in stage 3. That means if you get suspended, you are banned indefinitely with the ability to apply for reinstatement after a year. During that year, you continue to be subject to up to, I believe the number is either 10 or 20. I should probably look that up. It's a lot of unannounced drug tests every month, and you have no structure. You're exiled from your team. So the Browns have to sit back and just hope that this guy can ever come back. And the question becomes, if you build a receiving core without Josh Gordon, you get to a point where you just don't need the guy. So I think if you're the Browns and he gets that one-year suspension, you just have to move on and assume you're never going to have him again. And if you do have him again, that's a bonus. That's that $20 bill that you find in the old pair of pants if you ever do get Josh Gordon back. But he's proven to be one of the best receivers in the NFL. And this issue hangs over the Browns at a time when everything else is pretty positive and there's a new direction, a new beginning. Well, they may not have Josh Gordon for much, if any, of it. Another Twitter question. At a fire inside with some X's in the handle just to confuse me. And it worked. What do you see happening with Andre Johnson in Houston? I see Andre Johnson playing for the Texans for 2014. After 2014, is he still unhappy? Do the Texans believe he's making too much money? Are the Texans ready to move on then? I think one of the reasons he's unhappy is he's been trying to convince the team to trade him. And I'm a firm believer the team's not going to trade him. And I know Adam Schefter's reported this morning that the feeling around the league is the Texans aren't trying to trade him. Well, yet, if they're not offering him in trade, and if they've given no indication they're willing to trade him, and if they haven't done anything to replace him, that's a point we made as soon as the comments came out last week from Andre Johnson about how he's unhappy. There was no veteran free agent receiver signed by the Texans, despite more than 50 entering the market this year. There was no draft pick used by the Texans on any receiver. So they are planning to have Andre Johnson this year, and they assume, and they know him better than anybody. They've had him in the organization for 11 years. He can huff and puff, but he's going to show up and do his thing, and he's going to do it for at least one more year. And he's going to make $10 million this year, even if he doesn't. And I think he's probably already waived his ability to collect a $1 million roster bonus week one because he hasn't shown up for any of the offseason workout, and that's one of the requirements. But his salary went from $6.5 million to $10 million based on his performance last year, so he's going to be handsomely paid. The question is, how much longer beyond 2014 will he be a member of the team? I'd be surprised if he's with the Texans in 2015. The question is, will he be able to still play at a high level? And will someone else want him and make the investment? There could be no one out there that wants to pay him big money. You could see him walk away like Marvin Harrison once did when neither the Colts nor any other team was willing to give him what he wanted. What I want is to talk to someone, and what Will in Charlotte wants is to talk about the Carolina Panthers. Will, what's up?
Hey, what's going on, Mike? How you doing?
Good, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm just calling to ask a general question, and it's something that's always been on my mind. Every season, year in and year out, I listen to radio, watch TV, and it's always, oh, Carolina's not good enough this year. Carolina's going to finish in the bottom, this, this, and that. And it's never a point where there's any – nobody says anything positive about us. Like, and I'm just wondering, when is that disrespect going to stop? Like, when is somebody going to be like, hey – you know, Carolina's got a solid defense. Luke Kuechly just won Defensive Player of the Year. Cam won Offensive Player, Rookie of the Year for him. I'm just wondering.
Well, the problem this year is with all the receivers that are now gone and Steve Smith being cut and no real sign for hope on the other side of the coin that the receivers coming in are going to be as good as the guys who left. I think that has contributed to the idea that the team's going to take a step back. That's where it's coming from. And also the retirement of Jordan Gross at left tackle. And what have the Panthers done to replace him? Travell Wharton, by all appearances, is not coming back. So there's concern about the ability of Cam Newton to play at a high level. The ankle surgery that came out of the blue in March, that's also created this sense that maybe the Panthers are going to take a step back. And if you attach Dave Gettleman, the GM of the team, to a lie detector test and asked him if he really wanted to go 12-4 his first year on the job, he probably would say no. Otherwise, he'd be detected by that lie detector machine as lying, because that's a bar that you set too high in your first year with the team. He knows that because of the salary cap and other issues, they're going to reel that thing back in. And I think anything more than 8 wins this year will be exceeding expectations for the Carolina Panthers, because of the reality that they've had to lose some key players. And also, you look at the Falcons, you look at the Saints, you look at the Buccaneers. It's going to be a tough division this year. So I think that it shouldn't be viewed as a sign of disrespect. I think fans' expectations in Charlotte should be adjusted accordingly, because it's going to be a tall order to get 12-4 again. Another Twitter question, at rcoat225. Is Adrian Peterson going to have to share the load, and will the Vikings have to pass more with Teddy Bridgewater and Cordarrelle Patterson since Adrian Peterson is 29 going on 30? We know from time to time we hear that the Vikings are going to run the ball less, and that Adrian Peterson is going to have his workload reduced, and GM Rick Spielman has already said that, and I'll believe it when I see it, because until you have a passing game that can complement Adrian Peterson, you're going to rely on the thing that works, and Adrian Peterson is still going to bring it every week. He's the last guy that I ever want to underestimate when it comes to his will, his ability, his durability. The guy plays through every injury imaginable. He made it back from that torn ACL. He was the NFL's MVP in 2012. Do not count Adrian Peterson out. The challenge is to find that balance, and that's one of the things new coach Mike Zimmer is going to have to do. And I think there's a certain amount of a new sheriff in town mentality at play here. Yes, Adrian Peterson's the face of the franchise, but Mike Zimmer's the head coach. And what Zimmer says is going to go, and the question is, will he and Peterson see eye to eye? We've heard Zimmer talk about how he wants Adrian to be more of a leader. And Adrian, I think, is going to get to the point where he's going to decide if the Vikings don't develop a passing game, he's going to want to go lead somewhere else. And then meanwhile, every year that salary keeps going up and up and up and up and up. There are no other running backs making that kind of money. I think the Vikings come to the conclusion they want to move on from Peterson before Peterson comes to the conclusion that he wants to move on, because nobody else is going to pay Peterson the kind of money he's making in Minnesota. Last call, Lewis in Pennsylvania. You're on PFT Live.
Hey, Chief, I got a question for you. I mean, with all the weapons that Rob Ryan just picked up on the defense, being a breeze picked up Cook also, what do you think their chances are really taking it all the way this year? I mean, I'm a Dallas fan, a diehard Dallas fan, but I'm just taking a look at the competition defensively and looking at, you know, what else is out there in the NFL offensively, and considering that Elway just went down possibly for the rest of the year, who else is there to compete with them?
Well, when you look at the New Orleans Saints and you look at the division, again, it's not going to be easy, but at the same time, the New Orleans Saints were much better last year on defense. They couldn't have gotten much worse, and they're competitive, and they're a real contender. The question is, can you put together enough of a regular season record that you force a team like Seattle to come to you? You know, whether it's Seattle and San Francisco, where they meet in the postseason, is going to decide who advances. Seattle and New Orleans, where they meet in the postseason, is going to decide who advances. At a time when week in and week out home field advantage for most teams doesn't mean what it used to, Seattle, San Francisco, and New Orleans, whoever has the higher seed of those three teams is going to have the inside track to getting to the Super Bowl, because especially New Orleans and Seattle, if you can get home field advantage, you're going to be very tough to beat. That's the challenge for the Saints, and the problem is they're in a division now that's a lot better, so it's not like you're going to have six automatic wins, and then the question is how do you do against everybody else. They're going to have to fight and scratch and claw to win as many games as they can in that division. They may not win that division. If they don't win the division, it's going to be very hard to get to the Super Bowl. That's it for today's edition of PFT Live. It's great to be back. It's great to be back here in my West Virginia studio. I'll be back here tonight for Pro Football Talk on NBCSN. We were off all last week due to cycling, I believe it was. I know it was cycling because I watched it every night, as I always do. Hopefully you will watch us tonight at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time on NBCSN. Ross Tucker, Sean King, Eric Casilius in Connecticut, me right here. I think we're going to take a close look at the Browns, Texans, and Bills from the standpoint of how their offseason has gone, where the big question marks are, and whatever else comes up. We got plenty of stuff to talk about, and we will fill up that full hour. Full hour! We're no longer pinched by soccer on one end and hockey on the other, so full hour. Get to let it all breathe. Get to talk about all sorts of things. We hope you'll join us, and we hope you'll join us around the clock at ProFootballTalk.com. There is no offseason, ever, at PFT. We'll see you there. We'll see you back here again tomorrow. Have a great day.